two cases at the 9 o'clock docket, Wolnowitz versus Fideo and People versus Sanders. Have counsel checked in on both those cases? Have counsel received our written statement of instructions and procedures?
Yes.
Do you have any questions? For members of the audience, if any of you has a cell phone or similar device, would you please turn it off so that the lawyers are not interrupted in making their argument? And I know one of you in the first case wanted permission to use blow-ups. If you want to take a minute and rearrange them before we start the clock running, that's fine. All right, we're ready for argument then in Wolnowitz versus Fideo.
May it please the court. My name is Gilbert Marchand, counsel for Appellants. Here today is Suzanne Webel and her husband Ray Beauvais and Jean-Jacques Joris, who has substituted in for the Fidaus. They are the defendants in this matter. I'll refer to them today as defendants. I'll refer to the appellees as plaintiffs. The issue before the court today is whether the trial court erred in applying principles of inquiry notice on remand in this case, and charging defendants with notice of plaintiff's implied easement in lateral B. There were two critical errors I'd like to bring the court's attention to today that the trial court made. The first is the trial court imputed knowledge of this court's legal conclusions to defendants on the remand, and that is contrary to the very nature of inquiry notice, which assumes there's no knowledge of the claim. Second, the trial court ignored this court's direction to consider the undisputed evidence of non-use of the easement, and she applied abandonment law, which simply is inapplicable to this case. I believe the analysis starts with this court's opinion in the first round of the appeal, authored by Judge Webb in 2004. There, he interpreted documents under a standard of de novo review, and he concluded that the trial court had erred in denying an implied easement in lateral B. The court in the first appeal found that the intent to create an easement was reflected in the settlement agreement, the deeds conveying Tract D, and the Olson deed of water shares. Tract D is the parcel to which the lateral B easement was declared to be appurtenant. The ultimate conclusion of this court in the first round was that Tract D was conveyed implicitly as an appurtenance in the conveyance of Tract D. I think there's two important points that flow from the first opinion. First, the nature of the easement was an implied easement, not an express easement. Second, by definition and by the premises of the court's opinion, notice of this easement could have arisen only from on-the-ground conditions. And under inquiry notice law, that's curious or suspicious facts that would have prompted further investigation that would have led ultimately to the claim. Seen as a whole and around the time that defendants...
Mr. Marchand, let me ask you about that again. You're saying in the first decision that the court concluded there was an implied easement and that the court reached that conclusion based on matters of record in the property records. Is that so?
Correct, Your Honor.
And so the defendants were on inquiry notice as a result of those recorded documents.
I would answer the question by saying the court did conclude an easement existed based on interpretation of certain so-called pertinent documents. On a separate page, the court said various recorded instruments put defendants on inquiry notice of possible lateral ditch easements. I'm assuming some of those documents included the pertinent documents and some of them may have been other deeds, for example, the deeds from Olson to Darrow in the early 1990s that accepted from the warranty of title apparent ditch easements.
But the question I have is, do you agree that as a result of the first decision, the defendants were on inquiry notice?
They were on inquiry notice, Your Honor.
Okay.
Critical to the analysis is, what does that mean? And it does not mean they were on notice of the claim. They were on notice of possible lateral ditch easements across their lands.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. Inherent in the very concept of implied easement is that there's no recorded instrument that adequately describes a property interest in a recorded instrument. And it's not the type of easement described in the Hornsilver case, which set forth the proposition that to charge the purchaser of a servient tenement with constructive notice, there has to be a description of the easement and of the servient tenement burden that the easement burdens. And we did not have that in this case. And this court found in the first opinion that express easements in lateral B and lateral A were never granted by Olson to Ahmet or by Ahmet to the plaintiffs. And it's also important to note here as a precursor to the inquiry notice analysis that defendants had no actual notice of the easement. They had thoroughly investigated the lands and the title documents at the time of their purchase, but gained no actual notice. The court here found no actual notice in the first case. The trial court found no actual notice. She simply went through the roadmap to reach an inquiry, a notice from the inquiry notice principles that she applied wrongly. And plaintiffs have shown no actual notice. The first time defendants ever heard of the lateral B easement was when the plaintiffs filed the lawsuit in this case. And it's significant, as was pointed out in the briefs, that plaintiffs themselves apparently had no notice themselves of the easement until about 2 years after they bought their property, and they too had investigated the lands and not apparently concluded that a lateral B easement existed, because all the correspondence between the parties leading up to the lawsuit had to do with the lateral A easement that's no longer of concern here, but there was no mention of lateral B. So on the remand of this case, the question was whether on the ground conditions prompted, there were any curious or suspicious facts arising from those conditions that would have prompted further investigation that would have led to the claim. Critical at that point, I think it's important to emphasize that the trial court was not to assume defendants investigated knowing that an easement probably existed. Yet the trial court, in her opinion, February 6, 07 opinion at page 3, said she thought that the question was, assuming that the defendants knew an easement probably existed, the question was, did they determine that one did not exist? And I just think she had it backwards. I think under inquiry notice, it was improper to impute any knowledge of this court's prior legal conclusions from interpretation, de novo interpretation of those documents. Improper to impute that knowledge to defendants. The defendants did a thorough and reasonable investigation in this matter that I think the trial court ignored. They reviewed title documents, obtained title insurance, ownership and encumbrance reports. They walked the lands. Mr. Fidel walked lateral B, and Ms. Webel investigated all the lands and all the irrigation practices with the homesteader of the property, Harold Steele, and Richard Behrman, another very intimately familiar irrigator in the area. Ms. Webel and Mr. Beauvais even considered purchase of the Ahmet parcel, which is right here next to the Webel-Beauvais lands are these. This is the Fidel land, and Ms. Webel and Mr. Beauvais investigated purchase of this, and they had discussions with Ms. Ahmet, but no knowledge about an easement in lateral B was revealed. In fact, there were no discussions of irrigation north of the New Table Mountain ditch. Just irrigation practices on the lower parcel were discussed.
Is there any evidence in the record that any of the defendants specifically asked Sonia Ahmet if she felt she had the right to take water from lateral B for the benefit of Track D?
Defendants did not ask that. No, there's no evidence, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Nor would I expect there to be any evidence, because there was no curious or suspicious fact that would have prompted that question. Let's talk about what the facts were. This exhibit depicts the conditions of the land in 1996, around the time that the Fidels bought their land and about a year before the plaintiffs and Ms. Webel and Mr. Beauvais bought. Did the ditch exist? Yes, it existed, but it did not physically connect with Track D, and investigation of its use would have revealed that it irrigated the Fidel lands north and south of the ditch, the Track West Webel-Beauvais lands, and some of Track East, and some of this parcel over here.
Well, the trial court specifically found that the only way to get water to Track D was through lateral B. Why isn't that a factual finding that we are stuck with on appeal?
The question on remand was whether a reasonable investigation around the time of purchase would have revealed, number one, whether the ditch existed, and number two, would it have revealed that lateral B was the only way to get water from New Table Mountain Ditch to Track D. Your Honor, nobody would have thought to ask that question because nothing in the, on the ground indicated that anybody wanted to irrigate Track D. Simple answer. If some, and that gets to the question of imputing knowledge of this court's roadmap and the conclusions that this court reached in the first opinion. I submit to you that no one would have even thought to ask that question, what is lateral B the only way to get water from Track D?
Well, I think you're not quite answering my question, though. The trial court made a finding that lateral B was the only way to get water to Track D, and the trial court did so based on the trial court's visit to the LAMP. How can we say that finding was clearly erroneous?
Because, Your Honor, I think it's premised on an assumption that someone was assuming that there was an easement in lateral B to irrigate Track D, and assuming that easement existed, how would one get water there? I will submit there was never a dispute that if you wanted to irrigate Track D, that would probably be the way you would do it. But these people bought their lands and investigated title documents and walked the land and even talked to Ms. Ahmet, and the ditch didn't even physically connect with Track D and had never been used to irrigate it. There, in the case law I'd like to bring your attention to is that even if they knew of the settlement agreement, which there's no evidence in the record they did know of.
Well, a settlement agreement's recorded, so don't they have constructive notice of it?
They had no constructive notice of it, Your Honor. And number one, if they did, it doesn't describe their lands as being burdened with that easement. And number two, it doesn't describe the easement. Important point about the settlement agreement is that to the extent it said there was an easement to bring water to this parcel using whatever water rights were necessary, if you went and looked at that land, you would not have seen water rights used on the land. And that, under the Hazelwood v. Moore case and Park versus Park, is dispositive, I think, that a reasonable person looking at that would not think that water rights are physically pertinent to that land and therefore wouldn't ask, is there an easement that might connect with that land?
Was Hazelwood and the other case you referenced inquiry notice cases?
Where they were not, Your Honor, but they had to do with the question of what was necessary in order for a water right to be pertinent to land. Okay.
Are you aware of any Colorado case which has extinguished a duty of inquiry notice because the water rights are not currently being used?
Your Honor, it depends on the facts of the situation. And if there's a ditch that goes to the land, for instance, if they when they investigated Tract West and bought it was not being irrigated. But investigation would reveal that the ditch physically connected to the land and was historically used to bring water there. And I think that would put somebody on notice to investigate. On the other hand, if a ditch doesn't even physically connect, I'd say you might look to see, well, is there crops growing or has there ever been crops? And they just never would have found that evidence. So I think there's no Colorado precedent, and this is the point I would want to leave your honors with. I think there's no Colorado precedent to say that an implied easement, well, let me restate, to support the proposition that a never-before-used easement that's not physically appurtenant to the land that arose on an implied grant can impart notice. I have not found any precedent for that proposition, and all the cases that I have brought to the court's attention under the inquiry notice realm always involve at least some indicia of use. Littlefield versus Bamberger had some indicia of use, yet they even there found there was no inquiry notice. And in that case, the claimant of the easement didn't even know of his claim for a certain period of time, which is similar to the instance here where plaintiffs apparently did not even know. And I would like to conclude with that, reserving time. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is John Henderson, Law Offices of John R. Henderson, P.C., Boulder, Colorado, number 9013. With me today at the table is Mr. Richard W. Walnewicz, one of the original plaintiffs in this case, and his wife, Gretel, sitting behind. Your Honors, I would like to, in a sense, dispense of the oral argument that I intended originally to make and try to cut right to the gist of the issues as I see them here. The real question is this court prepared for the first time in Colorado history to rule that a conveyance of land, water rights, carriage rights, and appurtenances, including an explicit statement in the recorded settlement agreement of a statement of intent that tract the water rights be used to farm tract D, is somehow does not carry the lateral ditches in that conveyance or put others in the chain of title on notice that there are rights in those ditches.
Hasn't that question already been answered in your favor in the first case?
It has, Your Honor, and I believe that what is happening here is really a deconstruction of Colorado irrigation law. I think brief for the appellants is really a sub silentio attack both on this court's prior opinion concerning the appurtenancy of these ditch laterals and secondarily really attacking the adequacy of the transaction that was entered to settle this lawsuit. The briefs outlined with some clarity what happened in the lawsuit between Amatz and the other landowners. There was a Liz pendants, there was litigation, and there was an extensive settlement agreement followed by the sequential recordation of multiple implementing documents. Then ultimately, there was some cleanup work that had to be done when the settlement wasn't complied with. The court entered additional orders, additional documents were recorded. An agreement for dismissal was recorded in January, and a few days later, the Liz pendants was lifted, the same day that Mr. Darrow purchased the properties from Mr. Olison. Olison was the common grantor of all the parties. Then, of course, they went to Darrow, and then Darrow, through his family trust, to these appellants. In essence, I think the attorneys and the parties, specifically the Amatz, did everything they humanly could to document this transaction. In other words, they got deeds to everything, land and water rights and appurtenances, in its black letter Colorado law that in a conveyance of land and water rights, the laterals generally go as an appurtenance. In the world of ditch rights, you generally have principal ditches that actually are able to divert from the streams. Many of them in this state date from the 1860s and 1870s. They certainly do in Boulder County. In this case, the left-hand company then has a series of incorporated carrier ditches that carry water from the diverted water rights to various regions of the ditch company. Each of those is a separately incorporated company. The laterals are the lowest denominator of ditch. They're the small, relatively small ditches that often run for thousands of feet, sometimes for miles, and serve multiple properties. Principally, those are, as they are here, privately owned. I would direct the court's attention specifically to our appendix, that is Appellee's Appendix P39 Exhibit P517, which is the photograph of Lateral B looking west, and specifically Lateral B as it flows by the Wilnewich property corner. When the appellants here make the argument that this ditch is not connected or was not connected at the moment of conveyance, they're really saying that no reasonable person walking this ditch, which as they demonstrated on this blow-up and the trial court specifically found, is a very obvious and identifiable landscape feature. This ditch runs literally within about 20 feet of the Wilnewich property corner right there. The way of connecting that ditch is simply to do what was done, obviously, in the prior season here, lift a piece of sod from the side of the ditch. In the history of Colorado conveyancing, the literature tells us that even the prime ditches, many constructed in the 1860s, don't have deeded easements. If you listen to the standard that is being proposed here, and the other thing that they ignore is not just the prior Court of Appeals opinion and the facts on the ground, they also ignore the special status of Colorado irrigation rights, including ditch laterals. That's the law of gravity. A TV cable for my TV may run uphill in figure eights and it wouldn't matter. Ditches only flow in one direction, downhill. There's a specific place you look at for a ditch. You look at the end of a pipe passing under a road, pipes over the Boulder Feeder Canal. You look for objects as here, which have bushes and phreatophytic plants growing alongside of them as they traverse the field. You're looking at a very specific interest, and that's what they were on notice of here. those prior conveyances, as implementing the settlement agreement, conveyed some very specific things. Water rights in left hand, carriage rights in the new Table Mountain ditch. It conveyed appurtenances and it conveyed land, in this case, Track D, along with a specific recorded intent, which we rarely see in recorded documents. This is very well documented, that the water rights be used to farm Tract D. That's about as an explicit a statement of intent as you could possibly have between grantees and grantors. So you're looking for something very specific when you're on inquiry notice. You're not out in a Star Trek scenario looking for intelligent life in the universe. You're looking for a ditch that flows downhill from the Table Mountain Carrier Ditch to Tract D. Those things were all described, as well as other tracts of land that were included in that settlement agreement as well. So you're looking for something very specific. You're looking for something that can go from the Table Mountain Carrier Ditch downhill to Track D. And it turns out the trial court found, as this court pointed out, there is only one of those, and that's lateral B. So,
why, given that you're talking about water flowing downhill, why isn't there some notion that on the ground one would look at lateral A and say that is lateral A uphill from Track D?
Your Honor, we lost the right to irrigate our middle lands in the first appeal here. I wish I could reappeal that case, but the Supreme Court would not accept a cert on that. A similar argument of lack of connection was made, and I want to point out the absurdity of this argument as applied in this case. If you look at page 4 of the reply brief of the appellants, they state clearly that even Darrow had no notice in this case. Now, Darrow, of course, was the successor purchaser who basically had to see that the lawsuit was cleared up that had been going on for several years and finally implemented so that Liz Pendens could be released, took title the same day the Liz Pendens was released, took title subject to apparent ditch easements, and they say that not even Darrow had notice that there were irrigation rights in Track D. Under this standard, if the court accepts the poison meat that's being placed in the trap here, we will undermine virtually all Colorado irrigation rights, and we will see a situation where people will be shutting down ditch laterals much of the same way that they now shut down roads in the mountains, where they're just unaware of the irrigation history that's gone on.
Well, let's focus on that.
Yes.
Do you disagree that the prior owners uniformly said Track D had never been irrigated from lateral B?
Okay. I will stick with what was said in the prior opinion of this court. Two things have happened. There has been some incidental irrigation of Track D, just by virtue of the fact that if both the land to the north and south is downhill from this ditch, there's been some incidental irrigation, that's in the record, as well as testimony by Mr. Steele, the prior rancher, that the way he delivered water to Steele Lake is he placed a little X up here on the exhibits, he opened the ditch at this point and streamed water across a portion of Track D to get it to the lake.
But that's not for the purpose of agriculture on Track D.
In two senses it was, Your Honor. The lake was used both for itself for irrigation at other locations as well as for cows and grazing and that sort. So that is also farming, and using water rights in farming could include watering livestock as well as lands. But let me talk about appurtenancy, because I think that's what we're getting at here, is how did we know there was appurtenancy here? And I think this court has already ruled that these water rights were appurtenant, but the appurtenancy was established with regard to Track D by the settlement agreement and the implementing deeds. In other words, there was a specific statement of intent after the lawsuit and to resolve the lawsuit that these water rights be conveyed to and for the specific purpose of use for farming on Track D.
Okay, let's stop here. Is there any level of non-use that would extinguish a reasonable buyer's further duty of inquiry?
Not in this period of time, Your Honor, because I think this is an easement by grant to the extent these laterals passed as they normally do in Colorado conveyancing. If they passed by these deeds that carried land, water rights, carriage rights, and appurtenances, that you could not extinguish that by a period of non-use of a year or two. Here they're saying, actually, and I was going to finish my argument, they're saying the rights vanished instantly. In other words, the same day the Liz Pendens was released, Darrow took title. Darrow had, quote-unquote, no notice under their definition. They're saying these rights vanished instantly. And since the lawsuit was only settled that fall and the actual dismissal entered in January, there were zero irrigation seasons, which the Amats had to place this to use after the lawsuit was settled. They're saying these rights vanished instantly.
Well, as I understand their argument, it's a little bit different. I understand defendants to be saying a reasonable purchaser would ask questions of people like Steele and like Amet, have you ever irrigated your land? And the answer to those questions were asked, and the answer is, as to track D, was no. Do you dispute that?
Dispute that, Your Honor. There's no evidence in the record that these people were specifically asked about track D. As a matter of fact, the evidence is clear, and it's put in both briefs. The questions that were asked Ms. Amat were irrigation questions focusing on her use of water down in this area, how she irrigated. And as Mr. Marchand just told you, they did not ask Ms. Amat how or when or if she irrigated tract D. If we accept the standard that the appellants are asking for in this case, you would come up with two results. You would have to have specific called out descriptions of lateral ditches in a conveyance. In other words, just passing as appurtenances would not be good enough. We'd have to have specific call outs. And if you buy the argument they've made with regard to Mr. Darrow, the ditches would have to be in use for all possible claimed uses at the moment of conveyance. And there are many, many reasons in Colorado why ditches are not used all the time. A, water's not available all the time, or not even used all years. You have disputes like this one, lawsuits, divorces, bankruptcies, water shortages. There are some cases in Colorado where you have a non-use of a ditch easement that goes back 60 to 70 years. And in those early cases, the court was unwilling to say that there was an abandonment or that there was a lapse due to non-use, absent an overt act. I think the more modern authority would at least create perhaps a rebuttable presumption of the loss of rights by abandonment during the period of limitation of 18 years. I think that's a little more modern. Here, literally, they have argued on page 4 of the reply brief that these rights, though carefully documented, vanished instantly. And if that goes and becomes Colorado law, and we demand that the notice that's required be of not only of the specific claim, but the manner of irrigation, the place of irrigation, time of irrigation, and evidence of actual use, there isn't going to be a whole lot of notice. I think we should stick with the old rules of conveyancing. I once again commend the court's attention specifically to Exhibit 39 in Appellee's appendix to take a look at this and what they're really talking about when they're talking about lack of notice. In this specific case, what a reasonable person would do, if they're aware of these documents in their chain of title, and though we are now hearing some late arguments that somehow the settlement agreement wasn't in their chain of title, we briefed the fact that they had actual knowledge, at least that Ms. Webel had actual knowledge of the settlement agreement from title documents she had obtained, as well as this being in the chain of title, and there are two chains of titles here. You've got one chain of title to lands, you've also got chain of title to water rights. And when you have a deed, for example, as Mr. Darrow did, or as Mr. Fidow did, where you have a description of water rights, apparent ditch easements or ditch easements, you look for a ditch that leaves your property, and it would be leaving your property downhill, and that's what you're looking for. In this specific case, Your Honor, the settlement transaction and the implementing documents recorded in sequence were well documented, and those rights did not vanish upon sale to Darrow. Thank you, Your Honors. Are there further questions? Thank you.
Mr.
Your Honors, I direct your attention to the top of page 4 of the opening brief. Ms. Webble did not have actual notice of the settlement agreement. The standard that the defendants are proposing is not as problematic as plaintiffs would have you believe. It is true that in the culture and custom of ditch rights, ditch easements are frequently not expressly granted or recorded. In that case, use is what gives notice. In this case, Mr. Henderson focuses on a couple of years of non-use and the inability perhaps to use it, but the ditch did not even physically connect to the land, and I submit that that further distinguishes this case. And the standard we're proposing is that you can convey an easement like this through express language in a deed or an agreement and make sure it goes from the grantor and is properly placed in the chain of title. But in a case of an implied easement like this, there must be some indicia of use or other curious or suspicious fact that would put a person on notice. Recall that the trial judge had done a field inspection, and after that field inspection, she heard all the testimony of all the witnesses, and she concluded that both the condition of the land and the non-use were sufficient to conclude no notice. She applied the wrong standard because she did not conclude an easement had been created. But when you consider the fact that this was a merely implied easement and you cannot impute your legal conclusions to the defendants, then you realize that there really is no basis for her opinion to have changed in this matter.
Well, is it your position then that a physical appurtenance is required to have notice?
Your Honor, I would say it's a case-by-case analysis, but in this case, it would have had to have been. If there had been at least a physical appurtenance connecting Track D, and the fact that it's possible to connect it doesn't count. Philbrick and Powell state that mere potentialities do not work under inquiry notice. So here, if something had indicated that maybe the ditch had disappeared, but there had been previous irrigation, maybe that would suffice. But here we have no irrigation, no physical connection. We had discussions with the claimant of the easement, and she did not reveal anything about it. And she herself testified that the ditch is actually below Track D on the eastern end, and it's very difficult to irrigate with it. That was what Ms. Ahmet's testimony was. I'm out of time.
Mr. Marchand, if I understand Mr. Henderson's argument correctly, he's saying that in the settlement, there was an express conveyance of rights in the left-hand ditch. You agree with that?
No, Your Honor, the settlement agreement, it had paragraph 21, which, and first of all, the settlement agreement had many terms and conditions, and paragraph 21 was subject.
Well, apart from the settlement agreement, whether that literally does this, was there a conveyance of rights in the left-hand ditch?
Yes, sir. Contemporaneous conveyances of left-hand ditch shares along with Track D from Olson.
Okay. And was there also a conveyance of carriage rights in the New Table Mountain ditch?
That's never been disputed, that those rights were somehow conveyed.
And was it also expressly stated that all water rights necessary to the agriculture of Track D were conveyed? Are there words that to use such water rights as are necessary to farm Track D?
Paragraph 21 conveyed the immediate right to farm Track D using whatever water rights are necessary.
To what water rights would that refer if it does not refer to the rights in the left-hand ditch and the carriage rights in the New Table Mountain ditch? To what water rights would it refer if it doesn't refer to those?
Well, Your Honor, the water rights do not necessarily run with the land. And in this case, it might have referred to those if water rights were necessary. But Track D was part and parcel of the Ahmet property, which comprised Track A and Track D. There were multiple conveyances of water shares in the left-hand ditch system to Ahmet over time. They were all used down here. We had disputes in the first go-round about some use here. They were never used up here. And I submit that if you know nothing else other than you've got language saying use whatever water rights are necessary, I submit you look to use.
To use such water rights as are necessary to farm all of Track D. So they could, according to that, use whatever water rights, but then how did they get those water rights? How did
Those water rights, they actually owned, they could have gone out and bought other water rights if they had none and used them, but here.
How did they access those water rights if not through lateral B?
Well, I think we would agree that if one was asking, hey, I have an easement in lateral B and I want to irrigate track D, that lateral B would be how you would do it. But it's critical, just critical to realize that a reasonable purchaser in 1996 coming on this land is not going to be prompted to ask that question.
But they're on notice inquiry.
Of possible lateral ditch easements across their lands. And in historic use investigation of those possible lateral ditch easements reveals the irrigation of defendants' lands, but not of plaintiffs' lands.
So is your argument that if they're on notice inquiry and in fact engaged in an inquiry, one, they did not, as a matter of fact, they did not discover the easement?
Correct.
Is it also your argument that they could not have discovered the easement?
Your Honor, I would not say that. Ms. Amott could have said to Ms. Webel, hey, by the way, I've never used it, but I have this easement, and here's a settlement agreement. It could have come up, but it did not.
And does your argument rest on the bottom line that that they did not discover the easement? Is that the bottom line?
Yes, Your Honor. And I would add that assuming there was no record notice, because I would agree with Mr. Henderson, if you have a properly described easement, you would be charged with constructive notice.
There was no record notice of an express easement.
There was no record notice of this easement, I submit, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. A written opinion will issue in due course, and when the tables are cleared and the exhibits taken down, we'll hear argument in People versus Sanders.
Thank you, Mr.